like my hairstyle, I'm trying to go Rastafarian. I was watching Dead Poets Society, and I've been holding off watching it because I haven't seen it since it first came out in the movie theaters a few decades ago, because I know how it ends. And after Robin Williams' death, I didn't exactly want to see the movie. But I'm watching it now, and this guy, one of the actors, the students of the movie, is holding up an antenna, a radio receiving antenna, and it looks like it has both circles and a spiral, two circles at the base, and a spiral on top, all of it put together shaped like a cone. And Philip Nelson and I were just talking a few hours ago about radio antennas, and he thought the one he had was that he was describing was a conic shape, but it was not. He was mistaken, but it got me thinking. And this is where I ended up with that inspiration from the movie and from what Philip and I were talking about. I had it mistaken, and William Lyon was very polite in saying, in reaffirming that aluminum is the reflector, and I'm not going to say anything more about it, I meaning him. And that was a polite way of saying, you're wrong, but I'm not going to tell you what the answer is. And because I kept thinking that when he says that aluminum is the reflector, is that it's, whatever I thought it was, I now am transferring to copper, because let me start at the beginning. In Tesla's trimetal generator, I think what it is it's an AC generating system. William Lyon said that he said that the piston in the center, driven by the compressed air, was a reciprocating piston. It had to travel no more than 1/16 of an inch in its reciprocating motion. I'm thinking, because I just started a little essay on longitudinal and transverse about spirals and circles, I'm thinking that the reciprocating piston in that version that William Lyon is describing is a spiraling reciprocating action. In other words, as it's busy reciprocating back and forth, it's also reversing its spin at the same time. It's a corkscrew action. It goes clockwise when it in one half of the reciprocation, and I guess, depending on how you look at it, counterclockwise in the opposite. I guess it's following the same groove pattern. It's just going in reverse. It's reversing its spin. That's the important thing. It's reversing its spin with each half of the reciprocating cycle. And I'm guessing that because it's driven by compressed air, according to William Lyon, I'm guessing that it's like a squirrel cage etching along the sides of the piston and along the sides of the trough or cylinder that it's traveling through, creating kind of like a baffle effect to help it reverse its spin and do a corkscrew-shaped travel as it reciprocates back and forth. This is important because what it's doing, it's like an audio signal generator, but it's analog. It's creating an AC signal. And the purpose of it being, it would have to be aluminum, because of the purpose of aluminum, in my bet, see, I think the nature of aluminum is more than just vata. See, I started with the doshas, and that's good, but it goes further than that. What does aluminum do to our brain? It helps us forget. I think aluminum is the perfect reflector because it holds on to nothing. Now, the opposite of vata in tridoshic Ayurveda is kapha. And kapha dosha, I believe, is the iron. Iron, any kapha, if you know about kapha dosha, any kapha predominant physiology tends to put on weight. They're holding on instead of letting go. While a person who's vata-oriented will tend to be very flighty and then forget everything they just told you. At their peak, at the peak of vata. So they're opposites. So I believe that aluminum, like the center of the hourglass, is at the center of compression, in which electrostatic forces, I think that's why aluminum is put on the top load of a Tesla coil, because not only because it's circular, it's the only circular shape, it's the only perpetual motion circular shape on the unit. The rest is spiral, the secondary coil is spiral. It's an open circuit, but it's, well, sort of open circuit. And the primary is a spiral. That's all transverse, but the top load is circular. That's longitudinal. And longitudinal favors the production of electrostatic forces under pressure. So it's advantageous to make the top load a circle and not be a wound spiral shape. So, and but also it's best that it is aluminum, because aluminum will let go of anything imparted to it. It won't hold on to it. And iron is kept out of the core of the Tesla coil because they want a very high frequency. They don't want it to lag and drag. They don't want the iron to hold on to the frequency and slow it down, like an anchor weight, like pulling anchor. You know, yay, lift the anchor so you don't have to keep pulling it along the bottom of the ocean when if you want to try to go somewhere. So you put aluminum on the inside of this thing to create a clear signal, and this is the reason why. Because I think if you see, part of the problem of an AC system, literally, I think I know who the guy thinks, some guy on the energetic forum claims he knows who replicated Tesla's trimetal generator, and he wasn't going to say who, and he said, well, you know who. Well, I thought, yeah, it's probably John Bandini, because A, he's got material science behind him. He's, as a kid, he knew about all kinds of rocks and ores, so he would know about, I would like to think that he would be the one to resolve the issue of, well, how does copper behave, how does aluminum behave, how does iron behave. But there's more to it than that. Where was I going with that? Oh, no. John Bandini is an audio specialist. And I believe that Tesla special generator is an audio system first and foremost, first and last. The problem with a normal AC generator is it's a fuzzy signal that it creates. It's not a clean, crisp signal. My premise here is that aluminum will create that reciprocating squirrel cage-etched piston reversing direction of spin. Because, see, what I did was I thought about this, the spinning disc in a watt-hour meter. And I thought of a ballerina and an ice dancer, an ice skater. When they do a twirl, what do? They pull in their arms to spin faster, and they let out their arms to spin slower. Everything about the watt-hour meter is mediocre in its design. It's supposed to be, by every looks of the matter. And so as not to lend any credence or give us any notions of how to do it properly. So you've got this disc originally. And the other reason why I say this is because the ammeter, I believe it's called, there's a fellow on YouTube who has all these old meters that predate the water meter. And one of them has a drum. Actually, there are two that have drums, now that I think of it. There's an ammeter that has a drum, and then there's the Fort Wayne? This is Indiana. I think it's called the Fort Wayne model, because the company was called Fort Wayne. I think there was a town in Indiana called Fort Wayne, so not to be confused with, I think, Texas, there's a Fort Wayne. But at any rate, there's a Fort Wayne, I'll call it Fort Wayne because I can't remember any differently, a Fort Wayne version, which is 10 years older than my oldest watt-hour meter. I think it was 1901. It was built in 1901. They're even being sold on eBay, at least last time I checked. They may not be anymore. Probably they've been taken already. Fort Wayne, Indiana, and it had a barrel disc. Well, I mean, aluminum barrel that spun under the action of the voltage and current coils. Not a disc. Now, there was an ammeter that this other fellow had that had shown on YouTube that was a barrel with a disc at the bottom. But the magnets were around the barrel, not the disc at the bottom. I don't know what the disc was for. I forget. It had a purpose, obviously. So I think what they did was they moved away from the barrel because the barrel is too efficient. What is a barrel? It's a rod that has had its diameter enlarged, but it's still predominantly a rod in terms of length versus width or diameter, length versus diameter. But a disc has its width predominating over its length, the axle length, the axle of spin has shrunken down to like nothing. And so they've maximized its mediocrity, but by turning it into a disc. I think it should be a rod, a spinning rod. And that's where I got the clue that the reciprocating piston in William Lyon's version is a piston that does more than just pump back and forth. You know, this isn't like sex. This is truly to the word screw, meaning it's a corkscrew. It's reversing its revolution. Once I realized it's reversing its revolution, I realized it's an AC generator. And once I realized it's this tiny little thing moving no more than a 16th of an inch back and forth, that means its revolution is not going to be oscillating a whole lot either. But it's going to be lightweight because it's aluminum. That's the other nice thing about aluminum. Aluminum is that it doesn't carry a whole lot of weight, let alone anything else of an electromagnetic nature, which means it has taken off its clothes, so to speak, because electromagnetic clothes or hides the electrostatic naked nature underneath the electromagnetic. So you have to take off the electromagnetic, and you do that best with aluminum. So aluminum is at the center. It's reciprocating. It's also reversing spin. And so it's creating a clear, sharp AC signal. And the whole purpose is, if you can make a clear, sharp AC signal, now you've got the world on a string, because all you have to do is amplify it with iron, the next step, the breaking magnet, to pick up that influence and then transfer it to the copper that will distribute it to the load, the copper wound wire around the iron pickup. The iron is used as the pickup, the kappa, immediately after the vata, to slow down the influence coming off of that, turn it immediately into electromagnetic forces, but it's going to hold on to it, like the Dickens, in the form of a huge magnetic wave field, surrounding it. And then the copper picks that up and carries it away, distributes it, carries it to the load. It acts as the distributor of the system. That's why we have our wires with silver coated copper, because silver, copper, and gold and platinum are all in that same column of the periodic chart. They all have the same qualities. So it isn't just copper that would be part of the system. Silver could be too. Copper's cheaper, though. And it may have properties that are better than silver, granted. So there may be a reason why it has to be copper and not silver. But silver is a kissing cousin. It's pretty close. So that's probably why we put silver coated on our copper wires for certain applications. So we've got this clear, sharp AC signal that is so easy to produce because the aluminum is lightweight, and the aluminum will not impart a fuzziness to the signal. Because if you start out with a fuzzy signal to begin with, you start to beef it up by putting voltage behind it, represented by the iron of the pickup, and all you're going to do is make a mess. The fuzziness that was started by the initial signal is simply going to get more fuzzy. So not only are you going to get a stronger signal, you're going to have more power, stronger in that sense, but it's going to be weaker in terms of its AC nature. It's going to have fuzz all over it. It's not going to be a clear, sharp reversal. It's that reversal point between each half cycle of an AC cycle that's so critical that it be a clear, sharp reversal. We're told, oh, it's a nice sine wave. Well, that's mediocrity. Mediocrity. What does John Bernini do? He creates all these sharp spikes, and he shows it to us. Oh, there it is on the oscilloscope, all these sharp spikes. And that's the radiant event. Right. Because it's a short duty cycle with lots of gap of space in between, but it's that sharp spike. If you have a reversal represented as a spike going in opposite directions each half cycle with nothing happening in between during the course of that entire cycle, or even during the course of the half cycle, you conserve energy and you sharpen. Everything we've been taught is wrong. You've sharpened the clarity of the signal. Now you add power behind it in the form of voltage, and when you start stepping that down into current in the form of the copper wire, because this is an entire analog system, you get the voltage with the help of the iron, but you get the current with the help of the copper. Once you step down that voltage, that magnetic field, voltage in the form of an electromagnetic field, step it down into an electric, more oriented electric field by the help of the copper. Actually, it was a magnetic field. Now you've got power added to it, and you can distribute it to a load. But you've got power behind a sharp signal, which means you're going to have power like you've never had before. So the reason why we can't duplicate the device is because we don't understand the principles and how it works. Yeah, anybody could have said that. But it all goes to audio sharpness of the reversal of the AC half cycle between one half cycle and the next. It has to be a sharp reversal, not a sinusoidal wave. Later on, when we start adding more oomph to it with the help of the iron, it's going to smooth out a little. But if you start out with a fuzzy signal and you start to, smooth it out further by adding more oomph to it to beef it up, it's just going to be a bigger mess and a bigger smooth. What happens if you smooth a wave? If you keep smoothing it, it flattens to nothing. You've got nothing. So it has to be a sharp signal at its inception. And then once boosted, that sharpness, at least, we'll be able to get some mileage out of it before it gets worn down in the course of boosting it. Because it's going to get worn down anyway. You boost it, it's going to get worn down. It's like wearing down, eroding a mountain peak, It's going to turn into an undulating hill. Once you get it beefed up, it'll have this long, powerful wave. Yeah, but it's going to be smooth. And we don't want that, because it'll be useless. It'll be slush. It'll be like trying to ski on slush. Although I don't like landing on falling down when attempting to learn how to snowboard on hard pack ice, snow. That's the speed. You're not going to get it on soft snow. You're going to get it on the hard pack. So, that's the reason for the three metals, because they service three different purposes. And it's not just tridoshic. It has to do with the generation of an AC cycle system that has the finesse of a high-end, analog-oriented, audio, state-of-the-art system. Because if we're going to get 30,000 miles out of this thing, and we've got a limited supply of liquefied air to run the compressor to reciprocate this piston, it darn well better be a clear, precise AC reversal, sharp reversal signal. So there you got it. I mean, it's so simple, but once you understand the principles behind it, it makes more sense. So I was bumping around with a Tesla coil thinking, well, that's the only way to go, and it must be a perpetual motion holder. And I would pass these ideas infrequently, intermittently to William Lyon, and he might respond once and say, no, there's a big difference between a Tesla coil and a wattometer, or I may be quoting him wrong, a Tesla coil and a trimetal generator. And he was even saying that a Tesla coil by itself is a pretty good darn free energy device if you know how to use it. And I started scratching my head when I read that. So, whoops, that's going off on another tangent, obviously. I better stay focused here. But I couldn't, because I didn't know where to go with the speculation. How do you speculate? Well, you can't. I mean, it's either pure inspiration to see it for what it is, or you just don't get it, And Tesla got it, but how has it been duplicated? It hasn't been. So that's it. It's an AC generator. And that's the part that William Lyon never brought up. And I never asked him. Sure, the watt-hour meter is an AC-driven system, but he said it doesn't have to be driven by an AC electrical current. You can just use compressed air, right? He said in the book. You can have compressed air. Yeah, but what's compressed air running a reciprocating piston? That's an AC system. Duh. I didn't get it. Not until I transferred the image of a spinning disc changing, morphing its shape from a very wide diameter flat disc to a very high, chunky, thick disc that becomes so chunky, thick, and so narrow of a disc in its width of diameter that it becomes a long rod that is no longer spinning in one direction. It's reciprocating, it's reversing its spin. So there's so much to the watt-hour meter that takes us off course. The fact that the disc spins in only one direction. So we think, oh, it's like a homopolar generator. And it's it is, but that's not what the trimetal generator is. It's a reciprocating piston, which means it's reversing its spin. So yeah, it is homopolar still, because it's throwing off energy as it spins. But the diameter of that rod is so, and this is the other reason why I went to a rod shape. I still was hell-bent, obsessed on thinking that Tesla's trimetal generator is a perpetual motion holder in some way, shape, or form. So I was thinking, okay, I was thinking about what little I did to take apart my watt-hour meter, because I was afraid to take too much apart. I was afraid I wouldn't be able to put it back together again. So I looked at the disc and I thought, okay, it's got a brass axle. Not just the register. All the gears of the register on the dials are made of brass. But the axle of the aluminum disc is also brass, and you wouldn't know it if you didn't open up the thing and look inside. I wouldn't have known it. At least this particular, the I-10 model of the Westinghouse from 1910, had a brass axle on which was the aluminum disc. That means the disc had a hole in it through which the brass axle went through. I was imagining, I was speculating, I didn't take that apart to actually look at it. For all I know, it was a solid disc with two axles bolted on either side coming out of the disc, but I doubt that. It wouldn't make sense. So I was thinking, okay, brass is an alloy of copper, so now you've got two metals in there. What's the copper doing inside the axle? Well, duh, if the watt-hour meter was designed for mediocrity from the beginning to end, even though it retains all the elements of a trimetal generator, some of the basic essential elements, because it doesn't matter what you drive trimetal generator with, compressed air simply was efficient. It was an efficient choice of design. But in this case, we have an AC current driving the spin of the aluminum disc. But it's not part of it. That's extra. It's just something to drive the disc. Well, I was beginning to wonder, why did they put copper alloy of brass into the axle of the watt-hour meter's spinning disc? It was to slow down the spin. So it's a braking action of sorts. Not to slow it down. It would be to transfer. But still, it's transferring energy out of the disc when the disc should be building it up and imparting it only to the braking magnet, which will then pick it up to the coil that should have been wound around the demagnetized braking magnet. But see, so now it's leaking energy in two directions. It's not only being braked by the braking magnet, but it's leaking energy through the axle. So the axle was there to slow it down, just like the braking magnet, but in a slightly different modality, not to brake it directly, but indirectly by leaking out the energy, by passing the energy that was building up in that spinning disc of the watt-hour meter to the other parts of the system that the brass axle is associated with. And interestingly enough, the brass axle it's true, it's set into a jewel base on the bottom end when it's hung properly, correctly, hung the way it was designed to be hung, not the way I would lay it on the floor at 90 degrees different angle on its backside. But that axle is suspended in an aluminum frame. And I always wondered about that. What's it doing there? And then there's a wire, a shunt wire that is somehow into close proximity with that aluminum frame, but separated from it with a very, very wide insulator separator. The insulator separator, the non-conductive insulator separator, is something like, like 3/4 inch high. And it's a cylinder shape with a brass screw going through it. And the copper shunt wire, this is solid core, they use solid core wire, nothing stranded in this thing, goes into the insulator. I don't know where it goes to. But it goes into the insulator, and I think it goes somewhere like the brass screw into the brass screw is insulated by this sheath of insulation that surrounds the brass screw, so that the brass screw is insulated from the aluminum frame that it sits within. And it carries or distributes, by way of shunting, the energy from the current coil in the back through the aluminum frame to something else. I don't know what. I didn't take it apart to see. But it's going through a hole of this aluminum frame. There's a hole on either side, and they only took one shunt wire from the current coil and went through just one hole. The other hole was left unused, was not made use of. So this aluminum frame is what the copper alloy, the brass alloy of the disc is set within. So you've got the aluminum disc the brass axle and then the aluminum frame, as if the aluminum frame is this non-moving part that's associated with the brass, excuse me, with the aluminum spinning disc. Even though the brass frame is not moving, it's part of it because it's got the energy transported, conferred to it from the spinning disc through the copper distributor of the axle of the spinning disc, to the aluminum frame. So the whole aluminum frame is getting charged up with static force, electrostatic force, not just the spinning disc. It's only the spinning disc that throws off the energy. Wait a minute, no. To the braking magnet, but the aluminum frame is also throwing off the energy to the shunt wire that's passing through it from the current coil. Or to put it another way, the current coil is passing its energy directly to, by way of induction, to the aluminum frame. So the aluminum frame then is now serving as a core winding. Except it's not wound around. The copper wire doesn't go around it. It goes through it. Completely the opposite of what happens with iron. Well, it makes sense. Iron and aluminum are opposites in terms of tridoshic Ayurveda. So we put copper winding around our iron cores, but maybe what we're supposed to do with aluminum is pass copper wire through it to make use of the aluminum as a kind of core. So that means that shunt wire was connecting two cores together. The armature, that both the copper and the current coil and the voltage coils are wrapped around, along with the aluminum frame, which is the spinning disc. The spinning disc is a core to another winding of sorts. Except it doesn't have a winding, it just has a transference to the braking magnet, but it's the permanency of that braking magnet which constitutes the equivalence of what would have been a secondary winding wrapped around the braking magnet to pick up the energy and then transmit it to a load. So that's what I forgot. The braking magnet is not just a hunk of iron. It's a combination of stage 4 and 5. The hunk of iron is stage 4, and the permanency of that magnetized state of the braking magnet is equivalent to stage 5. The copper wire wound around the hunk of iron that would have been the distributor, taking off the energy from the hunk of iron and passing it to the load. Oh boy. I think that's everything. Oh my goodness. So, what does that mean? Does that mean the tube in which the piston, reciprocating piston of the trimetal generator, that is that tube aluminum also? Yeah, because I suspected that if I use the Tesla coil as an analogy, and it might even function as one too, successfully so, as another version. I think this trimetal generator is such a basic concept that there are so many different variations possible of how to incarnate this ideology, this concept. So, in William Lyon's version, I think the tube was aluminum, because I think the inside, the version I came up with that I put on Energetic Forum, is that possibly the iron pipe that is placed surrounding, as one version, surrounding the toroidal-shaped top load on the top end of the Tesla coil, the inside of that pipe should probably be electroplated with a bonded aluminum layer bonded to the inside of that pipe. That's, in my estimate, I think that's what would be the correct way to do it. We galvanize with zinc our iron piping, but instead of zinc, I think it should be aluminum. At least on the inside, adjacent to the space, across the space of the toroidal top load, the output terminal of the Tesla coil. So in the William Lyon's version, the reciprocating piston is aluminum, but the tube that it travels within should probably also be aluminum or aluminum-plated iron pipe. Cylinder, I mean, around which is wound the pickup. Now see, stage five, the copper winding. Now I have a problem with that. When he says reciprocating, he didn't describe that it be a cylinder. And I have a problem with that. I have a problem that it be a dipole. I have a problem that it be a... but it has to be. Doesn't it? Because if you try to put it in a toroidal-shaped cylinder, where's it going to go? It can't spin. It can go straight, but it won't be able to reciprocate its spin. So it would have to be a straight cylinder shape. And it only has to go a 1/16 of an inch. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't put an aluminum toroid piston inside a tube and have it reciprocate back and forth a 1/16 of an inch throughout the entirety of that tube. Problem with that is that it won't be able to rotate at the same time that it reciprocates. Now, maybe, just maybe, if you had two of these, okay, so now we're getting around, see, this is all about developing the idea, but it doesn't mean I have to hold on to the idea that I had before, because I was taking it from the watt-hour meter, but I don't have to stay there, because the watt-hour meter is mediocre as hell. If I have two cylinders that are toroidal, with two toroidal-shaped rings inside them, made of aluminum that are reciprocating, and they reciprocate in opposite directions simultaneously, I could have the bases there of an AC cycle because they're going in opposite directions. So they are mutually diametrically opposite, opposing each other, even though it's not their nature to, so they're forced to do this. Because aluminum is not going to have any kind of magnetic force, you know, that it's going to be repulsive against another piece of aluminum. So they're made to reciprocate in opposition in terms of time. So that one goes one way, the other goes the other way. But they're all hooked up as part of the same system to create that AC cycle. So when one is reversing its direction, it's reversing in a direction opposed to the other one, reversing at the same moment in time. And that should make up the difference for a lack of spin reversal. Because as it is, a spin reversal is not easy to pull off. And so I had considered it before, but I thought, I dismissed it. I thought, you know, where am I going to go with that? That's not going to be easy to pull off. And a Tesla was all about efficiency. That's why this special generator of his was so special, because of its highly endowed efficiency. So yeah, I think it should be not straight cylinders, but toroidal cylinders, two of them, with an aluminum ring inside of the aluminum cylinder, and they're both reciprocating in opposition 180 degrees over time in complete opposition to each other to create that sharp AC cycle that's totally balanced, because I'm looking for balance here. And I would expect it from a spinning rod, especially because the rod is so narrow, its ability to reverse spin will be so easy. And aluminum, it's all about a sharp signal. It's not about trying to create oomph. You do that at the next stage, stage four. With the use of the iron, picking up that electrostatic energy and converting it into a magnetic energy, and then the copper converting the magnetic into an electric. So it's a three-phase process between stage 3, 4, and 5, electrostatic, magnetic, and electric, in that order. But I think it might be pulled off better with two rings than with a single cylinder trying to reverse spin at the same time as reversing direction as well. Longitudinal direction, I mean to say. So in this case, all we have to worry about is longitudinal direction, which is originally what I thought was the only thing capable of being highly efficient anyway. But they're two cylinders with two rings going in opposite directions simultaneously. And that would be a complete AC system. In fact, the air entering one cylinder from a compression cycle it would enter the other one, but on the reverse angle. Yeah, and then they both exhaust at the same time, too. Unless you've got a four-part system, that would be even more efficient, in which two are exhausting and two are being filled all within at any one point in time. And two and one of each that's being filled or exhausted is going one way, while the other two are in the process of moving the other way. So it really should be four of them, is what they should be. Two exhausting while two are getting filled. Two that are losing their compressed air while two are being filled with compressed air on the push side. And one of each of those two push and pull, and two push and exhaust. It's not a pull though. Two compressions and two decompressions are either going clockwise or counterclockwise with respect to each other in terms of how they're wired, because it wouldn't make any difference which way they're flipped. I mean, they have no magnetic field; it's purely electrostatic. Although, wait a minute, electrostatic may have an orientation to its field. Just like electromagnetic does, why should electrostatic be any different? You take the clothes off the man, and what do? The clothes collapse on the floor, and they no longer have the shape of the man. The shape was imparted to the clothes by virtue of being on the man. So the electromagnetic field, or the electric field, or the magnetic field, for that matter, has its shape strictly because of the electrostatic forces that are driving both, or either one of them, for that matter. They come in pairs, so it's driving both. So it's the electrostatic that generates the shape to begin with. So where was I coming with that? That means that it does matter which way the cylinders are oriented. Now, if you have four cylinders, where do you put them? I just assume they'd be stacked in interweaved nature, and I think that's the only way to do it. So you have four in a stack. Now, you can build a system by way of parallel connection. Excuse me. In as much as you have sets of four, and they're all parallel connected to boost your system. If for some reason that appears to be a way to boost the power of the system, it would have to be in sets of four, because the minimum set would be a set of four cylindrical rings of reciprocating cylindrical rings inside of cylindrical toroidal shaped cylinders, tubes. So let's think about this for a minute in terms of a cycle. Just one in terms of an incomplete cycle. Air rushes in, it's under compression at one end. It forces the so-called piston. And I suppose the piston would be a C-shape. Or maybe it's even spiral-shaped. No. No, it has to be circular. Well, Tesla had, in fact, he had invented a hydrodynamic transmission drive, based on flat disks that are in close proximity, because he found that water adheres to metal. It does not want to bounce off metal. You shoot a water jet at a piece of metal, and it wants to adhere to it and change its direction by 90 degrees and go off at an angle and roll along the metal instead of bouncing off. So when bypassing water through the space between closely adjacent disks that are stacked on top of each other, the viscosity of the water is literally going to grab hold of that metal and cause it to spin. And that was his efficient turbine design. Gas, for that matter, is just a different expression of a viscous medium of water. It'll be the same thing. So you could have an air, just enough gap between the ring inside the tube, the circular tube, such that the air passes across the surface of the ring and causes it to move one way or the other way. So there's never really any air under compression. But it does have to reciprocate, though. I wonder about that, though. Yeah, but only a 16th of an inch. See, now, if it's only a 16th of an inch, that means it's just a straight piston being pushed from one end or the other. It's not a ring. For some reason, I want to stick with rings whenever possible. Either rings or spirals. But I like to, I'm trying to get away from this idea of cylinders, because I think cylinders is the least efficient way to create a system. You either create it using circles or spirals and nothing else. No cylinders involved. I gotta think about this. Unfortunately, it's not going to reciprocate with a clear reversal to create a clear signal. If it's merely viscously going across the surface of the ring inside the tube, it's going to want to slow down and reverse before it reverts. And so you'll end up with a sine wave. It's not going to be... So maybe maybe I'm fallacious in believing that it has to be a cylinder with sharp reversals. So these are the two extremes. If the objective is to create a sinusoidal wave, then it should not be a cylindrical-shaped tube with a cylindrically-shaped rod inside of it reciprocating back and forth, which might want to reverse its spin. That would be one version, with a squirrel cage etching on the inside of it to help create a baffle effect to help it reverse spin as it goes back and forth, or create a spin, for that matter, during each half cycle. That's one version. The other version that might be just as likely, and I'm not sure which is more likely, would be to create a sinusoidal wave, a sinusoidal reversal, in which you've got a ring, a solid ring inside of a ring-shaped tube that will slow down as it's about to reach its point of reversal before it reverses and then comes back the other way. And that's going to create a nice, smooth sinusoidal wave form. Because that's the only way to get it to reverse. If you're going to have... You can't have a C-shaped and a little space in the middle with air pushing back and forth. That's not efficient. The only way to do it is to cast air across the surface of the ring in between the ring and the inner surface of the cylinder that it sits within. So it's going to pick up speed as it reverses, and then it's going to slow down once the air is allowed to escape from the cylinder and reduce its pressure. It's not going to have the same viscosity. The viscosity comes from the density. So when the air is under pressure, it increases its viscosity and wants to grab hold of that iron that's free to slip back and forth. And it's going to pick it up, and then pick up the iron ring is going to pick up speed. Now, William Lyons said that all you have to do is spin a disc or a metal, any kind of metal, and it'll create an that's the Searle effect, S-E-A-R-L-E, that I read in Joseph Cater's book, Joseph Cater, the Awesome Life Force. He was talking about the Searle effect and anti-gravity, and all you have to do is spin a metal disc, and it'll create an electrostatic charge if you spin it fast enough. And we're talking really fast. So if you move any piece of metal, in this case, it's optimal to use aluminum because we're trying to create an electrostatic field emanating from this moving piece of aluminum. So it will be advantageous to use aluminum, but all you have to do is move it. So you use compressed air. Well, when the pressure increases, the viscosity increases, and that's going to move the ring inside this hollow cylinder. See, how much time am I? How am I doing? 3/4 of an hour. Okay, I better finish up before my... I hate it when... Okay. So, when the phone shuts off in the middle of me talking, where was my train of thought? So, when the air pressure goes up, the viscosity increases, and that's when the gripping action increases, and that's going to help accelerate the movement of the ring in a particular direction. And then, when the air is let out of the tube, the viscosity diminishes due to the diminishment of pressure, air pressure, and so then the ring is going to help, is going to be facilitated to slow down before the pressure is re-injected in reverse direction. That'll be a slamming effect, obviously, because not all the air is going to stop spinning. So it's going to be slammed. The air moving one way is going to be slammed against the air coming in at the opposite direction. But that disc, the ring, there's going to be a time lag between the time that the air enters the ring, or the cylinder, I mean, surrounding the ring, and the time that the ring gets the message, oh, the air is now moving in the opposite direction, we have to not only keep slowing down, but slow down really, really fast and reverse and then pick up speed. So the ring will always be lagging behind. It's just like a synchronous generator. And this is literally, I bet, where Tesla developed the idea from. He took the idea one step further of developing his synchronous generator system, his commutator-free synchronous generator system, and instead create this trimetal generator as an outgrowth of his synchronous generator development. While, on the other hand, I'm using the watt-hour meter as my point of departure, and I end up with realizing that it probably came out of his development of the synchronous generator and the synchronous motor. It's probably where it came from, because it's using the same principles. If it's done in a ring-shaped design. Now, whether or not it's better to have a sharp reversing signal or a sinusoidal signal, I don't know. I'm not an electrical engineer. So to me, I'm totally clueless. I could just as easily presume one version versus the other. I mean, I guess it would have to do with what application, what are you going to do with this energy, this electrical energy? Does it have to be sharp spikes with a lot of space in between, nothing happening? Or do you need something more sinusoidal? Well, if you're driving an electric motor that's driving the propeller at the back end of an electro U-boat, maybe what you need is a sinusoidal signal. But if you're doing communications in that sub, you're going to want sharp spikes, because there's no torque involved with a sharp spike. It's all about carrying distance. How far will that signal carry before it dies out? So you're going to want it as sharp as possible. You're not going to want a sinusoidal signal. But the sinusoidal, the advantage of a sinusoidal signal is torque. The advantage of a spike is speed on the one hand, but distance as a consequence to speed. How far will that signal go? And there is this implication that William Lyon made when he told the story in his book that the ELF wave of 13.5 cycles per second was the wave of choice, involving a 50-mile-long length of wire winding in this trimetal generator that imparted a wave that was 925 miles long. And I don't understand how that works, how you go from a 50-mile-long strand of wire wound around your generator that will impart a wave that's 925 miles long, but I guess it's something that I'll just have to learn sometime in the future, what that relationship is. So, what does that mean? It means we may have multiple reciprocations going on inside this device, because the submarine, the electro U-boat, is going to have two different purposes that it's going to need. It's going to need to communicate as well as to travel. So if you've got a cylindrical-shaped reciprocation in the middle of a toroidal-shaped sinusoidal reciprocation at right angles to it, you've got your whole system. Now, how they coordinate, if they do coordinate at all, mechanically coordinate in terms of the air compression driving them, I don't know. Unless each of the four parts is really one. In other words, it's not eight parts. Unless you have... Well, no, you can't link it that way because... No, they'd have to be independent. So now I've grown this thing. I started out with a single cylinder, and now it's eight. Four of them toroidal, four of them cylindrical. The four cylinder-shaped reciprocating actions are in the center, for some reason placed in the center, because they'd be stronger there. So they'd have a sharper signal, And they're the ones that are going to create the sharp spiked signal. So they would be placed in the center of the electrostatic field, in the center of the toroidal shaped ones that are more dissipative oriented because they're round. They're away from their center. Their center of gravity is outside themselves in the center of the toroid. So we place the cylindrical reciprocating piston on the inside of that toroid to be the AC signal that's going to be used for communication. And then we have the toroidal one around it that's going to be used for powering the electric motor that's going to be moving this thing through the water. So you've got an 8-part system to generate what you need, communication and motive force. And that's interesting because earlier this evening I was thinking about going over the time I spent coming up with the 8 main deities of creation, the Almighty being one of them, and Dharma being the second highest, and then the 6, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and Ganesh, Mother Divine, and Surya being the 6, because they have to do with the 3 doshas and the 3 gunas. And Dharma is the gap between the Absolute Almighty and the relative 6. And it serves as the dialogue, the interface between the Absolute and the relative, between the 1 and the 6. That's why Dharma is so important. But it's not the most important. It's simply penultimately second only to the Almighty. And it's funny because in the English language, in the Western culture, we don't have a direct translation of the word Dharma. It does not exist. But the essential nature of Dharma is smriti, which is memory. Boy, I'm getting off topic here. But I think it's relevant, sort of, somehow. Whatever, loosely speaking. Somehow or another. And smriti has more to do with desire than mere memory alone. Because it's with memory that we remember what we were supposed to desire. What our duty is. And that's usually what we translate Dharma into, is duty. We only do our duty if we remember what it is. I always thought the essential nature of Dharma was kama, desire. And so did Rajaram. By way of allusion, he didn't say this. I'm reading into it. He gave a lecture on January 12, 2012, was it? Maharishi's birthday, when Rajaram came out of silence, he talked about his misunderstanding originally and his correct version of understanding what is the correct motive force behind creation is not kama, it's not desire, it's memory. Without memory, there is no desire. Because if we don't remember what we're supposed to desire, then we are not going to have the recognition of what our desire is in the first place. So it all comes down to memory, not desire alone. I mean, we call it desire, but that's the surface level of looking at it. The real guts of desire is memory, is smriti. The guts of kama is smriti. While dharma is the net result, or the goal of what we're trying to do with our memory, is achieve the satisfaction of our responsibilities, our liability to fulfill our liability to ourselves to be happy, to be fulfilled, which is to perform our duty, which is to do what we're good at and what we enjoy doing. And that makes us happy, and that makes everybody else happy, because we produce something useful for everybody else to share. Anyway, that's what we're trying to do here with this trimetal generator. So it's an 8-part system. Wow. I think, just like William Lyon talked about the slave compass and the master compass in the UFO navigational system, because they could not use a compass because the magnetic field of the UFO would obliterate the use of a normal compass. The master compass was a gyroscopic oriented device oriented to the pole star. So I bet the cylindrical reciprocating action of the sharp pulse is the master pulse that drives the toroidal pulse. In fact, it may be that the eight are in pairs, in which one singular cylinder is wired in parallel, or excuse me, no, not, well, directly wired, whether it's parallel or a series, with its toroidal partner. But it's done in the fashion that the cylinder is the master and the toroid is the slave, and the cylinder is like the metronome that sets the beat, the sharp spike beat that the toroid is following or dissipating, might be a better way to put it, because it is dissipating it. It's surrounding it. So it dissipates it into a sinusoidal form instead of taking it away from its spiked version. So there's something. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of, you know, it's not like I can draw a schematic diagram of how this thing works, but I'm just trying to get the principles straightened out. So there's still some fuzzy zone, just even in the principles alone, or how they interconnect, how it's all wired together. But at least that's some of the basic principles. And I can't imagine what else to add, and I'm within my hour's time before my cell phone shuts off automatically. Unless I can think of something else to add, I could do part two. I could do it in another part to this. I covered a lot of ground. Sorry for screaming in your ear. I get so excited. It's the Vata in me. Oh, and the Pitta, too. Yeah, Vata Pitta. I can go back to my movie now. Well, let us run with this. I don't know how to write this down. I don't even think I want to bother trying. I'll just post this video and then maybe write it out later. I'm just too lazy at the moment.